There's just a ton of opportunity. You buy a website for 2x, you see, oh, their ads are all screwed up. I can fix that and double their revenue overnight. And then you can just flip that.
Welcome to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast with Craig Hewitt and Dave Rodenbaugh. This is a podcast documenting the journey as self-funded business founders and sharing lessons, tips, and tricks for businesses following the same path as ours. The journey is long and winding, but we're glad you're joining us for it. And now it's time to go rogue with Dave and Craig.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 44 of the Rogue Startups Podcast. Today, Craig and I welcome Matthew Paulson, the author of Email Marketing Demystified and the founder of MarketBeat, to our show today. Welcome, Matt, and happy holidays and happy new year.
Thank you, and happy holidays and happy new year to you guys as well.
Thank you.
So, Matt, you know, we met briefly, I guess both you and Dave and I all were at Rhodium Weekend a couple of months ago and kind of met briefly there and this time kind of engaged from there. And I think most people would know you, like Dave said, either from your new book, Email Marketing Demystified, which is fantastic, and encourage everybody to check it out. And I want to touch on email. I think we want to touch on email a little bit, but, you know, I like people who might not know you to get a sense of how you got started and where and how you found MarketBeat and that whole Genesis story a little bit.
Sure. So it was actually yesterday I got a notification in my Google AdSense account that I had my AdSense account for 9 years. So that was kind of the 9 year anniversary of me starting my online business. And it really began as kind of a personal finance blog. I was just interested in the subject. I was doing the get out of debt thing. I was a sophomore in college, and I wanted to write that story and just kind of share tips and hopefully, you know, make a little bit of money while I was doing that. So the blog was called Getting Green originally, and it was like gettinggreen.blogspot.com, which is long dead. But I did that, and I wrote fanatically. So I'd write like 4 articles a day. Most of it wasn't very good, but
holy
I did
crap.
Enough. I know, but most of it was enough activity where it just it was just enough activity where it started to generate some interest just based on the sheer volume. It's like Entrepreneur on Fire doing 5 shows a week. You know, somebody's going to listen to some of them. And that strategy worked pretty well for me early on. There was also like a website called Associated Content that would basically license your articles for like $5 a piece. So I made like $2,000 a month as a sophomore in college writing articles and licensing them to that website and then putting them on my own blog as well. So it was a neat little business for a few years. I did the personal finance blog thing from kind of very late in 2006 to kind of like early 2010 when the Google updates started happening. I took a hit in some of the traffic things. I was making maybe $50,000 a year doing that. So it wasn't my day job by any means, but it was a nice, very nice side income. When the first Panda update hit, I got hit pretty hard. I was doing some pretty aggressive things with promoting Audible's affiliate program. I had created automated like press releases for every audiobook in their database, and I got those to rank pretty well, and I was getting like $7,000 or $8,000 a month in just commissions from them, and that all went away overnight. My personal finance blogs took a hit as well, so my revenue basically got cut in half when that first Panda update came out, and it was like, okay, you know, I need a new game plan here. So I kind of did an evaluation. Okay, what's really working? And the kind of the bright spot amongst that kind of chaos was that the investing stuff that I was writing, whenever we'd write a story about like a publicly traded company, it would get picked up into like Google Finance and MSN Money and places like that. And, you know, I kind of recognized, hey, you know, whenever we write these stories about these publicly traded companies, we get traffic. So why don't we just kind of pivot in that direction and, you know, write about investing in stocks and see what we can make out of that. And that's kind of where the genesis of MarketBeat came from. Originally, you know, it was just an advertise. The site was called American Banking and Market News. It's still up, but we would write about stocks, get traffic, and then, you know, just get AdSense clicks and stuff like that. But I kind of knew that, you know, that traffic wasn't guaranteed forever, so I didn't want to let's kind of bank off that. So, you know, I was listening to Internet Business Mastery one day and they said, hey, you should have an email list. And I was like, yeah, they're right. I should have an email list. So I put an opt-in form on my website. It looked like crap, and started getting emails. And I had to send them something to give them your email address. So thought, it's like, okay, what do I have that I could send out to people? So I just made a very rough and dirty kind of daily email newsletter with some stuff about investing in it. And it really kind of took off from there. And now we have more than 300,000 people get our daily newsletter. We have several subscription products. We'll probably do about $2.7 million in advertising revenue in gross revenue this year. We send out about 12 million emails a month now. So the business has really blown up.
Wait a minute. What? Was that 12 billion with a B?
No, million. Million.
Million. Well, I mean, okay, I'm sorry. 12 yeah. million is still huge, right?
Yes.
But yeah.
Yeah, we have a pretty big monthly SendGrid bill that we get to pay, which is I'm more than happy to give them money because they do a great job. But we send out a lot of email. We have a lot of subscribers, and the business has doubled in 2013 or 2012, 2013, 2014. We won't quite double this year, but it's been another big year for growth. So I'm thrilled with what we've been able to do, and hopefully I can share some wisdom with some other people as a result of what we've learned.
Wow, that's super awesome. So a question that I have for you is, when you started this whole thing and you just, you know, said, okay, well, I'm going to start sending out these emails, did you have any inkling at all that this was going to be as big as it became when you started this? Or was this just a total surprise? I mean, I know financial services is a pretty lucrative market in general, but did you ever have any idea that it would be an email list of 300,000 subscribers today?
No, it was really a surprise to me how much it grew. I had done kind of the portfolio entrepreneur model before that. I had lots of little different websites and businesses that made money. And then, you know, one day I kind of woke up and it's like, oh, MarketBeat is making 85% of the revenue of my company. You know, I should probably make some adjustments. So about 18 months ago, I kind of started on a path of getting rid of everything that wasn't MarketBeat. So I sold a bunch of websites and a couple of businesses. And that's kind of how I got started at Rhodium Weekend. I knew there'd be buyers there. So I just went and started talking to people and made, you know, probably just under $500,000 in website sales at the first time I went there last year. So that turned out to be a pretty good conference for me. So it was really a surprise how fast it grew. And then, you know, really a matter of, okay, this thing's growing like crazy. Now I've just got to double down on it and really see what I can make it.
We'll link to your blog post about that. I know you blogged about it a couple of weeks ago. I think it's a fantastic summary of your logic behind it and a little bit of how you did it and everything. It was great to read that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
I love the title, Putting Your Children Up for Adoption.
It seems to be kind of a common practice among, you know, guys like us. You look at Rob Walling and how he's gotten rid of everything recently to focus on Drip. You look at Patrick McKenzie and how he sold his last two things to focus on Stockfighter. So it seems to be a pretty common pattern among, you know, bootstrappers like us.
I do think it's a little against our nature, though, right? We're tinkers and experimenters and always have all these new ideas and thoughts. And probably for most of us, and that's the reason that you're very successful just getting around to it, you know, a year and a half ago. I think it is against our nature and something we have to be conscious of at least, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about starting like a WordPress consulting business when I had a business that did $500,000 a year and I was going to get maybe $250 or $500 a pop. But I thought, hey, this might actually work. I could make some money doing it. But, you know, I didn't really have the kind of bigger picture in mind of it's like, okay, if I spend time doing this, you know, what am I not going to be able to do on my much bigger business as a result? And it's I think it's an internal struggle for guys that always want to, you know, make something new and create a new little business. And it's, you know, I have to tell myself no pretty regularly on ideas just because it's not a big enough opportunity compared to what my existing opportunities are.
Yeah, that's a constant struggle. It's the same thing that I had when I was working on SupportVine, my customer support tool. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. I had to basically shut it down 18 months into it because I was just dumping tons of time and money into it, and I wasn't seeing the return on that I was seeing on other things. So, you know, even though it was interesting, even though it definitely scratched a particular itch, it was still one of those moments of, is this really going to put you to where you want to be? And the ultimate answer became no, but it took me a damn long time to get there, unfortunately. Yep. So yes, I feel your pain on that one.
Yep.
So Matt, I know from talking to you and reading some of your stuff, you're a pretty technical guy. I think you wrote some of the back end stuff from what used to be Analyst Ratings Network for your email system. And at this point, you run, like you said, mainly a subscription and ad revenue based sort of business model. How is that working for you? Are you feeling like you need to scratch that technical itch, or are you pretty well seated in running the business and being the sales and marketing kind of mind of it on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, that's a challenge. I used to be one of the guys that would be regularly playing with new programming, libraries and techniques and languages and all that stuff. And I think there's definitely been a shift in my life to focus where I only really care about programming in the sense that it solves business problems for me. For me, I think what's more interesting than just programming code is kind of, building the systems to run the business kind of without me. So in a way, I'm programming my business. I'm not so much writing code on an everyday basis. I mean, I still write all the code that maintains our software systems and does email delivery and all that stuff. And, every now and then I do something new, but I just don't have the time or the energy or the ambition to kind of tinker and play and learn and go to code conferences and stuff like that I used to. And that was kind of a conscious choice I made. It's like, okay, I'm going to learn enough to kind of know what I have to do. I think I write pretty decent code, but it's, it can't be the hobby that it used to be for me.
Yeah, that's a definite switch in terms of when most single founders are kind of going through that, hey, I'm the technical guy, and now all of a sudden, hey, wait a minute, all of a sudden I'm the business guy now. How the hell did that happen? So, so let's get back to Email Marketing Demystified for a second. And like Craig said, this is a fantastic book. If anybody hasn't picked up a copy of it, you definitely want to do that. There's a lot of real depth and breadth to it, which I really liked about it. So my question is, when did you actually decide to write this beast? Because, I mean, first of all, the amount of content that's in this book is huge. So obviously it was a pretty substantial undertaking for you to document all that stuff, talk about the ESPs and how they behave and your personal experience, and then all the awesome tricks and tips that you got in there. So what prompted that move? When did you want to start doing this?
So kind of the way my industry works is that during the summertime, there's not always a whole lot going on, especially like kind of later in May, June, early July, up until like kind of between May 15th and July 15th, there's just not a whole lot going on. So I had some free time. And last year, or in 2014, I had written a book called 40 Rules for Internet Business Success. And I thought, hey, I think I've kind of forgotten the pain of writing a book enough where I could write another one. So I didn't have a whole lot to do for a good solid month. I kind of knew I wanted to write another book just to, know that I had it in me again to pull that off a second time. Not a big financial success by any means, but I just wanted to give it a try and see what I could do. So I just kind of sat down and started writing one day, and I basically wrote for three, four weeks straight. And I just kind of forsook everything else I was doing just to get that done. So I kind of wrote the 50,000 word manuscript in 3 or 4 weeks, actually, just by focusing on that, only that. I stopped going to events. I stopped having lunches with people. I probably didn't spend enough time with my family during those weeks. But it's like, okay, I'm going to sprint on this. I'm going to do what it takes to get this done. And then I'm just going to be done with it. And then I'll go on to the next thing. So it was, It was a fun kind of marathon to run, but once that was done, it was kind of done. Then, the editor had it, and you had to get it, do all the other non-writing related stuff to the book. So it was kind of off my plate at that point. And then we launched it last fall, and we had like 5,000 downloads the first week. Those were all for like free downloads, so you don't really make any money off of it. So I think a lot of people have read it, but I would not write a book unless you've got a big back end behind it to cash in on that. It's not a business model I'd recommend.
When you mean a big back end behind it, you mean other sort of digital products and things, and use the book as the top of the funnel?
Yeah, I mean, look at Dan Norris had the book The 7-Day Startup. He has like a back end. He just had a book called Content Machine that came out around the same time mine did, and he has a membership site that's kind of the next step for people that buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was pretty clever. I didn't have the ambition or kind of the need to do that, but I think if you're going to write write a book, it should be the front end to something deeper, whatever that may be, that where you can make some more money. Because, I mean, if you sell a $3 book on Amazon, you keep $2.10 of that, and you have to sell a whole lot of ebooks on Amazon to make any amount of money that's worth caring about.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to make a real go of anything, because a book is a very one-time kind of thing. I mean, it has sort of a long tail to it, but there's this big pop, and then it just trickles out on the side. And then second of all, you can't sell it for a lot of money. Like $4 is an expensive ebook on Amazon. And then on top of all that, you know, they take a 30% cut.
So for an ebook on Amazon, you get 70% of the cut.
70%. So it is
for 30%. Like a print book, it's like 30, maybe 25, 30%. And then the audiobook is really where you cash in. I make $500 a month for my audiobooks, and then maybe 100, 200 a month from the print and ebooks. And yeah. I think you just get a good cut on the audiobook, and then, you know, they sell for higher. So there is just a little bit more money to be had there.
Yeah, definitely not getting rich off of that anytime soon.
Nope.
So what was your favorite section of the book? I could tell you what mine was, but I'd like to hear your take on it.
I actually liked the last chapter the best, and that was kind of the Stelly FD, here's how to do cold email outreach chapter. Like the first however many chapters are all about building a list and doing your autoresponder series and sending email and monetization, but that doesn't actually work for every type of business. If you have a business where you have higher prices and relatively few customers in kind of a narrow niche, you really just have to go find those customers, and you can still use email to do it, but it's an entirely different strategy. So it's, you know, going on LinkedIn profiles, trying to figure out their email address, sending an intro email, trying to get them to respond. I just like it because it's more of an outbound approach. It's a little bit more aggressive. And, you know, if you really just have to go dig up customers, that the outbound email marketing chapter is really kind of has a nice guide on how to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Outbound or cold email has sort of seen a resurgence of late. And that's how we got our first few customers with Podcast Motor. And it's really blossomed since then. Now we have sort of this organic machine behind it. But cold outreach is a great way to sort of manually kick the bucket. And I liked that. I liked that one and some of the list building stuff a lot. Just I think building a list is just such a valuable asset for your business, no matter what sort of industry you're in.
Hey, we should talk about Rhodium Weekend a little bit.
Sure. Let's talk about Rhodium.
What possessed you guys to go to that, and what do you think you got out of it?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So do you mind if I answer it first, Craig?
Go for it, man.
All right. So for me, it was about two things. One, I felt like I needed to have some direct connection to brokers and other buyers and sellers, because I hadn't really had some in-person time with anybody in that space in, well, pretty much forever. You know, I had some virtual connections when I was doing stuff, buying and selling more on Flippa, and when I originally wrote my buying and selling websites book. But since then, and because I was sort of looking to a larger acquisition, I really felt like having that opportunity to network right then and there was going to be immensely valuable to me in the next 12 months. And absolutely it was, getting to connect with David Newell of FE International and Mark Doust of Quiet Light, and just lots of other people I met there, being able to talk to Chuck and how he was running his business, and Jason Glaspy and how the two of them had bought and sold a particular business and tossed it over, and they went through that whole due diligence process on stage. I thought that was super valuable. And then aside from just that, I wanted to kind of level up my game on buying websites again, because I was moving into a whole class of website buying that I had never really experienced before, where you're doing things like seller financing and SBA loans and things that I just really didn't have a lot of experience with. So that was what it was for me. Craig?
Yeah, for me, it was a lot of the same things. I mean, it's funny, Dave and I both sort of, I think, evolved into being in the market to make an acquisition around the same time. And probably part of it is we had Chris Yates on the podcast 6 months ago now. Late summer probably, and that was kind of my introduction to, you know, he really has built an entire business on acquiring and running websites, and so you know, kind of wanted to go there, meet the people, see what they were really doing with their businesses. Because I think you can listen to a podcast or read a blog post or whatever, and that's all good and fine. But when you go and you meet Jason Gillespie or you meet Chuck and they're really doing interesting things with businesses that they've acquired, I think it puts a different spin on it. So that's why I went. And yeah, I mean, it really... I think the whole that whole paradigm between maybe when we had Chris on the podcast, some things I learned since then, and then Rhodium, and then since then I have made an acquisition, and it sort of changed my perspective on the trajectory I want my business to take. And it is, I certainly don't think I'll ever start another business, just because I think the leverage of buying an existing business is so good that starting one from scratch for me doesn't make sense. And I think for, you know, at this point, I can see sort of buying, building, improving, maybe selling and leveling up websites as being kind of like a core business for me going forward. I mean, the business that or the websites that we acquired are in kind of the travel space. So they're severely sort of under monetized right now. We're kind of redoing a lot to them. And I can see, you know, a year and a half from now, selling them for double or triple what we bought them for. And then leveling up into a SaaS product or something like that. And I think that's a fair model for a lot of people, regardless of your background.
Absolutely. I think there is a ton of opportunity, especially if you have a certain you know, skill set to kind of build and monetize and kind of maintain websites. There's just a ton of opportunity. You buy a website for 2x, you see, oh, their ads are all screwed up. I can fix that and double their revenue overnight. And then you can just flip that and you know, sell that, you know, 6 months down the line. And, you know, just double, you know, an investment pretty easily. I think it's a big opportunity. I think those opportunities are probably going to shrink over time as kind of the market for income generating websites gets bigger. I think there's right now there's a big imbalance between supply and demand. There's just so much more demand than there is supply that it's a good time to sell websites. When I had stuff to sell at Rhodium Weekend last year, it basically all went right away. Even they had a $400,000 business I sold. It took like 3 months to close the deal on it. And that is a surprisingly short amount of time for that big of a deal. And I didn't even need to find a broker. I just had people there that wanted to buy it. And now, you know, every now and then, like, you know, my buddies over at FE International will chide me a little bit and say, hey, so when do you want to sell Market Beat? And then you can just tell
them. You laugh with a great evil laugh.
Yeah, they told me. $1 trillion. No, but Dave Newell told me with a straight face I could probably get $7 or $8 million for it. And he's like, "Whoa, that's a pretty big number." So it's amazing just the demand that's out there right now. If you have anything that generates, you know, income, you can even $1,000 a month, you can hand it over to FE International and they'll sell it for 3x revenue for you. So it's a great time to sell websites.
I think, you know, it's funny. I was talking to Mark from Quiet Light about it. And he said the problem is, the reason there's such an imbalance is these guys that have sites that are making 6, 8, 10, 20 grand a month can't sell it and go buy a good 2x kind of revenue business. And I think that's the reason for the imbalance. So many people that are in your shoes or in my shoes or in Dave's shoes are looking at their assets and saying, I've built this. I can't replace the income I'm getting from it in the current market. So it really is sort of a seller's market, I guess.
Yeah.
For that reason.
Yeah.
That makes it hugely imbalanced when you're trying to buy something. Like, there are some SaaS multiples on FE International right now that are going way, way above the average, which it makes it really hard to determine if that deal is going to make financial sense to you.
Yes.
So why, Matt, why did you go? You sold all these businesses last year and you went back this year just because you had such a good experience last year?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun last year. So I decided to come back. I like going to Vegas. It's a good way to kill a weekend or so. So last year in 2014, they had a competition to like see who was the most helpful person at the conference. And I gamed the system. I had a rental car. So I gave everybody a ride to the event venue. And then whenever I give somebody new a ride, basically the way it worked is you'd have sticky notes and you'd write the name of somebody and then like put it on their poster board. So whenever I gave somebody a ride, I would hand them a sticky note. It's like, okay, write your name on this. And then I would go put it up on my thing. So I got a free trip to Rhodium Weekend this year just by being the most helpful person there last year. And that was kind of funny. But I mean, I'm going to go again next year, even though I have to make ask for it. But I think it's just a great conference. The speakers are okay, but really the value there is just the networking and how high quality people there are there. Because, I mean, if you're going to be, if you're a person that's buying or selling a $50,000 or $100,000 website, you're probably not like a newbie fresh out of the gate. You've got some background behind you, and there's just a lot of really smart people there, and I always get ideas out of there. And I just can't recommend that conference enough.
Yeah, I totally agree. So switching gears a little bit here, I know that you have probably experienced a little more pain on this than a lot of other people regarding copycats. So how would you say that copycats have impacted your business?
Yeah, so I just wrote a blog post on this. It's not public on my website yet, but I shared it with the Rhodium Group. And
I wonder where I got the idea for the question.
Yes.
it was a great article, by the way, but yeah. I think it merits more discussion because, I mean, every single person that I have ever talked to has run up against somebody who's tried to copy their product. It doesn't matter whether you're a tiny, tiny little WordPress plugin, you're, you know, doing a mini SaaS site, or you're, you know, in a financial services with a 300K mailing list, it seems like somebody wants to go out and duplicate success. So what has your been your experience with that?
Yeah, I've had copycats. I've had a lot of them. People that have tried to basically rip off my entire business, kind of replicate it end to end. And some people have copied parts of it. And most of the people I've copied are from countries that there's just no legal recourse on. So I'm, you know, really, it's there's nothing you can do about it other than, you know, people that steal content, you can do DMCA notices with Google and stuff like that to kind of give them a headache. But that's really all you can do. I've kind of some people are really secretive about their online businesses and they won't tell anybody anything just to try to avoid those copycats. But it's not really a good long-term game plan, because if you get big enough, you know, people are going to notice you anyway. Like if you have the biggest AdSense account in any given industry, people are going to take notice of that and they're just going to copy you anyway. So, you know, being silent about your online business doesn't really work, because once you get big enough, you know, people are just going to figure you out and copy you anyway. So that's, you know, being kind of secretive about your businesses, I don't think that's a good game plan. I think you just need to have a business that not anybody can just run. Like if you have an Amazon FBA business or an eBay business back in the day, or just AdSense websites or Amazon affiliate websites, those businesses are pretty easy to replicate. So, you know, my challenge to people listening to this podcast is just to build something that's, you know, a lot harder to replicate. So like with MarketBeat, you need a pretty unique set of skills to run that business. You have to understand, you know, financial SEO, how to create financial content at scale. You have to understand monetization, email opt-ins, how to write email marketing copy. You have to do landing pages, subscription products, and get lots of financial data. And there's just so many different skills that you need in that, that it's very difficult for anyone to copy that business. So it's, you know, what kind of unique combination of skills do you personally have that you can create a business that basically nobody else can run other than you? And if you can come up with a business like that, you know, it's people will try to copy you, but then they'll fail miserably. So it just really won't matter. And I guess the second point really is that of the people that have copied me, I've always gotten good ideas kind of based on what they've done. So like my first copycat was this other financial news website called Benzinga. I had been promoting some of their stuff as an affiliate, and they kind of took notice of my ratings newsletter, and they came up with their own ratings newsletter. But they had come up with a couple of new concepts to make their newsletter a little bit better than mine. So I just, okay, two could play at this game. So then I just took their two ideas and added them back into my newsletter. And then, you know, really whenever I've had a copycat, like I had somebody that was basically creating identical content to what I was and putting it in MSN Money and Google Finance, and they were outranking me. So it's like, okay, what's this guy doing, you know, in order to get these rankings? And then I was able to figure that out, you know, put it in mine, and then I, you know, had more traffic than I ever had before as a result of learning that from that competitor that had copied me. So it's, you know, I don't see competition as a bad thing or copycats really as a bad thing. Whenever somebody copies me, I always learn from it, and, you know, really just have to rise above that and outcompete people. Even when people just blatantly rip off your business, usually the people that do that are from, you know, a third world country or a second world country. So it's, you can't really go after them always in, you know, a legal manner. And, you know, part of the internet is still the wild, wild west, and you have to be okay with that and just be willing to operate in that. I mean, I don't think anybody would choose to have copycats, but I think if you do, I think there's a better way to respond than to just get mad about it. Instead, you know, it's like, okay, what can I learn from here? And then how can I make that my business better as a result of that?
Hey, Matt, that your comment about, you know, having a unique set of skills to run MarketBeat, it really kind of rings true, I think, and it's obviously why you've done such a great job. You have a lot of tools that you use to accompany your skills as well. And you go through a few of them in your book, specific to email, but just kind of rapid fire. Do you mind like kind of listing off what some of your favorite tools are for people to kind of help them grow and run, you know, their sites?
I think my favorite tool right now is SimilarWeb. And you can use that to basically see where your competitors are spending their ad dollars and where they're getting traffic from. So if you have somebody else who is in the same space as you and they're already successful, that's will give you a pretty good idea of how to get started and give you marketing channels to try. Like I can, you know, type in my competitors and see, okay, these are the top five domains that are referring traffic to them. These are where they're spending their ad dollars. There's probably some things I should try as well. I really like that tool. I don't know if there's lots of tools I use, but so many of them are specific to my business. Like I can talk about how awesome Google AdSense is, but it's not right for everybody.
No, SimilarWeb is a great one. I mean, it sounds like, and I think that would be good for most types of businesses too. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah, actually, after you had pointed that out in the Rhodium group, I went and started poking around on some of my competitors on that. So thanks for the hat tip on that. I thought that was very useful.
Yeah, I think so. I can probably share a few tools in terms of monetization that might be helpful to people. If you just have a content site, a lot of people run Google AdSense by default, and that's totally okay. Most people do their AdSense stuff wrong and they don't put the units in the right place. So if you have AdSense, you know, test the heck out of it, try different units, try different colors. AdSense actually has built-in report or split testing now, so you can change colors and all that stuff. And I think there's actually a service that'll do that split testing for you. I can't remember the name of it.
We can look it up, yeah.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
There are a couple other ad networks I really like. There's one called AdBlade that basically does kind of those Taboola style kind of content ads. Those pay pretty well. There's also some in-text ads from Vibrant Medium that those work pretty well. If you have maxed out your three AdSense units, there's a little network called PubGalaxy that I work with on some of my websites that's done pretty well for me. So if you have a content site, I'd encourage you just not to stop at AdSense or Amazon Associates and try out some of those other networks and see if you can, you know, get some additional revenue out of those. I guess those would be my monetization tips. For email, there's a lot of good stuff. You know, I use SendGrid for email delivery. If you need a traditional ESP, I like Drip. I like MailChimp. They both do the same thing in different ways. And, you know, Drip is a little bit more modern, but it's also a little bit more expensive. Let's see, there's a service called Mail Monitor, and that will basically tell you whether or not your messages are actually getting in people's inboxes based on an ISP. So you say, oh, my open rates were down. Then you can go in Mail Monitor and you say, oh, for some reason, Hotmail is putting my stuff into the spam folder. So that's kind of a neat way to diagnose your email stuff.
Does Mail Monitor only work with like an email provider, or can you have it check like your basic Gmail account?
Nope. So what it does is it gives you a list of email addresses to put on your mailing list. And then whenever you send a message, you send it to those addresses they give you. And they basically have addresses at all the big email service providers like Hotmail, Gmail, Yahoo, whatever. And then it can see based on the messages you send them whether or not this stuff is getting into the inbox.
Ah, interesting. Okay. So you live way the heck up there in South Dakota.
I do.
And I think it's fair to say that Sioux Falls is not what you would call a founder-friendly town or a tech-heavy town. So Can you tell us what it's like being a single founder in that community there? Have you had trouble connecting with other entrepreneurs because of the location? And do you have any advice for people that, you know, live in some place that's not Silicon Valley or a random tech hub in the United States here?
Yeah, you would think it would be basically a desert for that kind of stuff around here. But it's actually, there's more activity than you might think. There is a co-working space called The Bakery that's got 300 members of people that all own their own small businesses that it's kind of a big hub for entrepreneurship. They have events, you know, 5 times a week that you could go to. We have events like A Million Cups where there's an entrepreneur that gives a 6-minute talk every like Wednesday at 9 a.m. You know, there's chamber stuff. I could go to an event, you know, basically 5 days a week if I really wanted to. So there is, for being a town of 150,000 people in the Midwest, we have a surprising amount going on. There's probably, you know, maybe 5 or 10 people in the city that have, you know, really successful online businesses like me. Like there's a guy that lives 4 blocks from a house that does 100K a month in SEO work out of all things. So there are people here, but it's, you know, I'm not going to be, you know, there's not guys like you just down the street from me that I can meet with every week. People that have online businesses, it's, you know, they're here. There's not very many of them. So a lot of what I have to do for networking happens over Skype and you know, stuff like that. And obviously I go to a lot of conferences. I don't have very many good flights here. I always have to go through, I have to go like through Denver just to even get to Las Vegas or through Dallas to get to Austin or through Denver to get to LA. So I try to go to a lot of conferences. That way I can network with the people I want to network with and, you know, still, you know, live where I want to live.
So speaking of networking and connecting with those types of people, you know, I'm sure you have sort of a dream list of people that you want to connect with that you hadn't quite caught up with yet. And sort of at the top of that list, who would be like a one person you want to connect with, sit down, have a cup of coffee with, and what would you want to talk to them about?
Ooh, good question. I would probably pick like Robert Hirschovec from Shark Tank. He was at a conference called Freedom Fastlane Live that I was at a couple weeks ago in Austin. And he was the closing keynote, and he just had a lot of really good stuff to say about businesses and how they grow and what it takes to get to be a $50 million company. I'd love to just sit down with him and, you know, talk through how I can scale my $2.7 million a year business into like a $25 million a year business and what that would actually take.
You'd rather him than Mark Cuban, huh? I mean, just going on the Shark Tank line.
Yes, I think I would. I think, you know, Mark Cuban had one really successful business, and that was enough to make him a billionaire for life. I think Robert has had to work harder because he wasn't, you know, part of the big tech boom in the late 90s that just made him a billionaire overnight. And I think Robert really had to claw his way to become like a $50 million a year company. And he has had a lot of great startups or companies that he's invested in through Shark Tank that have done really well. Like he has like this business called Tipsy Elves where they make funny, ugly Christmas sweaters, and they scaled it up to like $25 million a year. And it's like, you know, if he can turn a Christmas sweater company that does like $1 million a year into a $25 million a year company, it's like, what could he tell me about my business that would, you know, help it scale, you know, in a similar fashion?
That is a good conversation. I would love to listen to that conversation just to hear tips even at a lower scale. I'm sure that some of the information that he would be dropping would still be hugely valuable to anybody even in the six-figure range.
Absolutely. Yeah. The cool thing about that conference was they had a VIP level where you could pay a couple grand, and then you got to take all the pictures with all the speakers. So I got a picture with like me and Gary Vaynerchuk, and then like one of the Priceline founders that happened to be a billionaire, and Robert Hirschovec. So I got some cool photos out of that conference.
Nice, nice. Yeah.
I don't, not an ROI in there, but it's pretty cool to have those photos.
It's good for a mantelpiece discussion piece, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of investors, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into angel investing at this point and how active are you right now with that?
Yeah, I'm not terribly active. I just really wanted to learn about doing that. And in South Dakota, there are some local angel funds that invest in companies that come out of South Dakota. And there's an organization called the Enterprise Institute that kind of facilitates all of that. When I first wanted to get in that space, I met with them and talked, you know, okay, what's going on here, you know, locally that I can learn from and get involved with. And they gave me some advice, and I kind of realized that, you know, if I want to invest in, you know, tech at all, I basically have to do it through AngelList, which is kind of an easy way to get involved with angel investing, but probably also a very good way to lose a lot of money. You know, you can, you know, there are people that are taking money on there all day long for their startups, and, you know, who knows which one of them are going to be the next Uber. But, you know, probably about 18, 24 months ago now, I thought, you know, hey, I'll stick, you know, 500 grand into here and just kind of see what happens. So I think I put money into maybe 10 companies on AngelList, and I don't really keep track of them too much to know what's going on. None of them have gone bankrupt so far. A couple of them seem to be getting some traction. So it's going to take 5 to 10 years to know whether or not that worked out well for me. I'm actually kind of moving away from some of that stuff. Like, I'll invest in businesses where it's where I know the founder, and I think I could help them out a little bit. But I won't just, you know, I'm not doing the Silicon Valley angel investing stuff anymore, just because you have no control over the money or what it's going to get spent on or anything like that. And you're just such a small piece of the puzzle, you don't even matter. It's like, if I'm going to spend money on that, I'd just rather stick money into some dividend stocks that are going to grow over time. So locally, I've invested in, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's kind of like gambling, except you don't get to play the cards. Somebody else is playing your hand for you. You yes. just threw up some money there, and you're hoping that they're going to be a good player.
Yep. Like, there's a local computer repair shop that was going to – I needed inventory or needs inventory, and I'm talking with the owner there, and I'll probably give him a loan or some kind of equity deal, and hopefully I'll get a little piece in that. And I don't know if it'll work out or not, but I'm having that conversation. It's like, I kind of like those deals more than I do, you know, trying to find the next Uber, because, you know, you're helping out a local business owner. You can – you know, help them out in their business, just by giving them advice and a little bit of money and seeing what happens. I had one deal, business I'm involved with called US Golf TV, that I did that with about 18 months ago now. They had an email list, and they had some traffic, and they just didn't really know what they were doing and how to connect all those pieces together with their products. So I got a little stake in that company. I gave them a little bit of money to pay off some credit card debt that they had in the company. And I basically got 20% of it, and we got – when it took that business from 80K a year to 200K a year between last year and this year. So that was kind of a nice little deal that worked out, and I get, you know, checks for 5 or 10 grand here and there. So I kind of look for deals like that where it's, you know, I don't have to do a whole lot other than tell them kind of what to do and give them a little bit of money for equity and give them some advice. It's not a big part of my world, but it's fun to do, and I'm always looking for the right deal to come along where that kind of opportunity presents itself.
I like that that sort of model and idea a lot better than, like you said, just sticking money out in San Francisco and hoping that it takes off, you know, to the moon, because it follows the conventional wisdom of a lot of investing. It's like, invest in things you understand and know about. And I think, yep. You know, whether it's the computer repair guy down the street or Market Beat or USGolf.tv or, you know, whatever sort of thing that's in our space or is in a market that you understand, I think you have a lot better chance of making a good investment and maybe even, like you're saying, helping those folks out along the way. And that's the big differentiator against like the conventional market, I think, is you can actually be involved and make a difference.
Yeah. I think that's going to be my focus from here on out. I'm kind of done on AngelList and doing stuff like that. But, I mean, there's like a local solar company that's making these, basically these solar panels that kind of fit into a briefcase, and they use them to power like medical clinics and places in Africa where there's no power grid. And there's a guy working on that locally, and I invested in his company, and I just think it's a really cool idea. And I don't know if I would get that money back, but, it's kind of fun to be involved with that and kind of know what's going on and give them ideas and advice. And, you know, it's definitely the very slim minority of my investment portfolio. It's maybe 7 or 8% of my investments. I mean, most of my stuff is just in good old classic dividend paying stock. You know, if you get a 5% dividend and you hope it goes up by 10% every year, you know, 10-ish years from now, but the dividend keeps growing, you know, based on your original investment, you might be getting 10-12% back just in terms of the dividend on your original investment after a decade. So there's most of my money is in really boring investments. And I think, you know, that's probably going to be more my focus in the future than crazy AngelList stuff.
Nice. Cool. Well, Matt, do you have anything you want to leave folks with?
Yeah. So Email Marketing Demystified is a $3 book on Amazon, and I put a lot of work into it to just hand out some helpful advice about email marketing. So if you're not, if you have any kind of online business and you don't have an email component about it yet, I'd strongly encourage you to, you know, start building your email list, collecting emails, and then seeing how you can monetize that later down the line. So if you want, you know, a really good resource and just kind of the step-by-step process to implement email in your business, you should check out Email Marketing Demystified. It's on Amazon. You can just go to myemailmarketingbook.com. It's $2.99. The one cool thing I'll leave you guys with about email is if you think about like a Google AdSense ad, in a very high-paying niche, one of those ads might pay, you know, $5 to $10, you know, CPM for that ad. If you think of like the pop-up on my website as an ad, just in terms of the real estate it takes up, that ad unit, if you think of it as an ad, that just the opt-in forms generate $140, you know, page RPM, you know, on my website. So it's, in terms of the real estate it takes up, it's, you know, any, you know, 28 times more valuable than what my AdSense units do. So it's just an incredibly great way to turn, you know, web traffic into money. If you haven't done anything with email, I would strongly encourage everyone listening to do that.
And amen. Can I just add to that for a sec?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, the title of the book sort of implies, hey, you know, if I don't know anything about email, I should get this book. But if I know something, maybe it's not really a thing for me. I just like to say that's absolutely not the case. You know, I didn't feel like I was a total novice at email marketing, but there was still plenty of information in there that I thought, because of the depth that you brought, that it was very valuable to not just the beginner, but somebody who is intermediate or even very advanced in email marketing, because there was just a few handy little things in there that I'm like, oh, I had no idea. Like your little unsubscribe link trick. You know, you say report spam, and then what you really do is you actually unsubscribe them from your list, and that helps keep your spam rates down.
Yeah, you know, there's
awesome it's tricks like that.
You know, it's a very dense book. You know, I don't do a whole lot of illustrations or examples or do what most business books do and have like a book that could be written in one page that gets stretched out to 300 pages. It's 250 pages of solid, dense material on email marketing. So if you're a newbie or you've been doing it a while, there's still probably some tricks in it for you to pick up.
Awesome. Cool. Matt, thank you so much. Can you tell folks where they can kind of connect with you on the Twitter spheres?
My Twitter is Matthew DP, D as in dog, P as in pony. I'm on there every now and then. I'm also on Facebook. I'm probably more active on that. If you search for my name and add me as a friend, I'll probably add you back. And then I have a personal blog at mattpaulson.com. Paulson is P-A-U-L-S-O-N. And then if you want to email me, it's just matt@mattpaulson.com.
Awesome. Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And that's our episode for this week. If you have any questions or comments, please let us know at podcast@roguestartups.com. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Rogue Startups. And be sure to visit roguestartups.com for full show notes on each episode. If you're enjoying the show, we'd sure appreciate a review in iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.